Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Dr. Victor Zhao, recent CEO of Duke University Health System and incoming president of the Institute of Medicine, about healthcare leadership in a sea of uncertainty, part of our CEO series on healthcare, and an interesting and important guest.
Yes, you know, Christy, Dr. Zhao has influenced healthcare as much, if not more, than almost anyone in this region. And he's going to be in Washington doing the same thing at a much larger scale. So really excited about the conversation we can have from and learn from him about what we need to focus on as a nation in healthcare. But first, we have some interesting research that matters about questions on legalizing medical marijuana. And does that lead to higher rates of teen marijuana use?
And does taking cholesterol drugs give people a license to overeat?
We talk about texting and driving as teens. What about parents of young kids?
And BMI and a link to breast cancer risk after menopause.
Body mass index. We'll talk about that. This very first research that matters, Christy, was in the Journal of Adolescent Health about this concern that if we legalize medical marijuana in states, does that give an implicit message to teens that marijuana use is okay, and would that lead to higher rates of marijuana use among teens?
So the research team examined 20 years of data from states that do and do not permit medical marijuana use. And what the data showed was that nearly 21% of teens had used marijuana in the past month, but there was no significant difference in pot use before and after the state legalized medical marijuana.
And I think this, you know, is a pretty good reassuring aspect that under the appropriate conditions that many of these states are implementing medical marijuana laws, that it doesn't lead to higher marijuana use among the teens. It doesn't say anything about, well, what happens when you decriminalize marijuana use? That study I haven't seen. But I think this is a step towards helping understand and basing what you do on data.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think it should be reassuring to parents and people in those states that although we all should be having conversations with our teens and keeping open communication, that particular change, at least to date, has not changed the use of marijuana. 21%, though, among teens is kind of a lot.
You know, Christy, we were talking recently that we need to be doing a show or two about marijuana and medical marijuana use. This is an important topic, and I want to find out more. And so we're going to get one of the top guests in the United States on our show.
We are. Look forward to hearing talking to that person.
By the way, what states have the highest rates of marijuana use? What do you think?
Well,
you would have said Colorado, right?
Colorado. Yeah, Colorado.
They're number three.
California.
They're number three. Colorado's number three, and California is pretty far down there. Despite our thinks of it, it's actually number 10. You know who the top two states in the country are that have, in terms of use of marijuana? Alaska, 16% of the state's residents use marijuana, and Vermont, 16%.
Vermont.
I know. We'll find out more.
All right. We're looking forward to that. But let's talk about cholesterol drugs and eating. So lots of people are on these statin drugs or various cholesterol drugs. I think there's some estimate that it might reach up to 56 million people that are eligible for these medications. And this was a study to see what happened over time with people who are taking these drugs and how many calories they eat in a day.
So this research study was in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal Internal Medicine. And it was based on this idea that, in general, a decade ago, when people were taking statin drugs, they actually ate less calories a day than those who weren't on these medications, thinking that they were worried about their diet, they were trying to lose weight, these cholesterol-lowering drugs were part of that strategy, and they ate less, which was a good thing. But the researchers had some thoughts that things had changed.
Yeah, they found that statin users were consuming about 2,000 calories per day back in about 2000 on average, compared to almost 2,200 calories a day among non-users. So they were eating less then. But over time, calorie consumption among the statin users increased. And by the mid-2000s, there was no difference between the groups, suggesting that as people were taking these drugs, they sort of were like, oh, I can eat a little more. I've got my cholesterol medicine on board, so I'll just kind of eat what I want.
And perhaps even worrisome to me is that maybe they're not really following the dietary interventions they should be doing. So I think this is a wake-up call. You know, we're going to talk in a second, Christy, about some research about body mass index and weight and the difference between primary prevention and secondary prevention. And I think primary prevention is what we're always really trying to work on, avoiding taking medications if possible. And this is something that doesn't really stress that, but it says, boy, we got to pay attention to it.
Yeah, so if you're taking a statin, don't just go eat everything you want. Really work on changing your diet, losing weight, and then potentially being able to come off the drug or decrease the amount that you have to take of the medicine in order to keep your life in check.
Speaking of keeping your life in check, this next research that matters is very concerning, Christy, and it was in the journal Academic Pediatrics, and it was a survey of parents with young children and how often those parents are using their cell phones and texting and doing all kinds of things, surfing the web while their children are in the car.
It's really very disturbing. 90% of the parent drivers said they engaged in at least one of the 10 distractions examined in the study when their child was a passenger and the vehicle was moving. So we're talking about texting. A third of the people said they texted while driving their child. Many said they're talking on their cell phones and calling people. There are other distractions like turning to give food to their child and other distractions in the car while driving.
I was following a car the other day, Christy, and a parent was driving with the child in the back seat, and I saw the parent turn around to give the child something in the back seat, and the car moved within an inch of the guardrail on a busy interstate at about 65 miles an hour. And I was, you know, far enough back, but then I saw it a second time where it almost happened. So then I started honking my horn really, really, you know, loudly at the car, like, you know, you're about to have a huge wreck that could kill a lot of people. And unfortunately, you know what happened?
What happened?
I got a gesture outside the window, which was not kind.
Oh, no.
But I get, you know what? They paid attention they stopped the behavior that was happening. So I felt at least okay about that.
I hope so. I think, you know, when you're first driving your child, you're all so careful and so nervous to drive them home from the hospital. But we do sort of get complacent over time. And this is a good wake-up call for us as parents to put that phone down, to really focus on driving as the primary thing and keeping our families and the other people on the road safe.
And listen to music.
That sounds great. We'll listen to music, sing songs.
Speaking to listening, this last research that matters is about listening to what our bodies tell us about weight, particularly if you're a female and you're become menopausal. This is maybe a really great way to reduce your breast cancer risk.
So this was part of the Cancer Prevention Study 2 Nutrition Cohort, which was a big study. Started in the early 1990s, and they followed people over time, questionnaires every two years, and followed their cancer risk. And then as they examined the group's breast cancer diagnoses over time, they found that both body mass index, which is sort of a measure of your overall weight and health, as well as a larger waist measurement, was linked to a higher breast cancer risk.
And the whole question in the past is, did it matter if it was just the weight or was it the size of the distribution? Did your body look like that pear? And so it's just
the apple
or, you know, different elements and different fruits. But I think it really matters that it's not the fruit that matters. It's the calories that matter and the excess weight here. And this is just a great take-home message here. There are really simple ways, not simple in their execution, but simple in what we need to do to lower your cancer risk. And this is one of them. And, you know, we had Dr. Ned Sharples on our show recently talking about cancer prevention. This is a great example.
It absolutely is. Well, we had a chance to talk about weight and link to breast cancer risk.
About texting and being kind to people when they point out that you need to change your behavior.
About cholesterol drug users needing to pay attention to what you you eat in addition to taking your medicine.
And that medical marijuana laws do not appear to increase teen use of marijuana. And we are going to talk about marijuana on an upcoming show.
Well, that concludes the Research That Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a short break. But when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Victor Zhao, recent CEO of Duke University Health System and incoming president of the Institute of Medicine, about healthcare leadership in a sea of uncertainty. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Victor Zhao, recent CEO of Duke University Health System and now president of the Institute of Medicine, in our CEO series here about healthcare leadership in a sea of uncertainty.
Welcome, Dr. Zhao.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Now, you have had a fascinating and remarkable career path that's taken you from physician scientist, researcher, and clinician to the leader of an enormous, over $3 billion healthcare system at Duke, and now transitioning to the Institute of Medicine. What has been your driving passion and your guidepost through all of this remarkable success?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, I'm a physician. And I believe really in service. And sometimes, you know, you give service by treating one patient at a time, and sometimes you have the opportunity to make a difference through your research, and sometimes you can make a difference through administration and leadership. And throughout my whole life, I felt that I have felt that this is the way which I can give back, which is through service, whether in any of these capacity.
You know, you talk about kind of three phases. I wonder if any, think back to the time when you were actively seeing patients, and if there's anything that strikes your mind as something that you remember as really important in influencing who you are. And we might even do the same thing for research as well. Anything that comes to mind, some experience?
Yeah, I think the just asking on the spot coming to mind, I think about where the research and patient care converge. Very early in my career, I was interested in developing a drug for heart failure. And this is my work on ACE inhibitor, you know, that people take now, Zestro, and
Lisinopril, Captopril, all those prills.
Right, all those prills. And I was very actively involved with this. So I was doing bench research and trying to understand the system called renin-angiotensin. And we got to a point where we say we can block this in human and actually develop some synthetic drug in our own lab. My own lab meaning my mentor's lab. Now, of course, drug companies came in and make really good drugs, save a lot of lives. So I remember very clearly a patient who is a patient with severe heart failure who came in, you know, we call moribund, I guess the average a layperson, it would be, you know, pretty close to death. Mm-hmm. And he had to sit up to sleep. Hmm. You know, we know that patients with heart failure, when they lie down, they get so short of breath because their fluid builds up in the lung, they have to sit up, right? But he couldn't even lie down. So he'd be leaning over the table right next to the bed and sleep that way, emaciated. And we started this whole treatment with whatever we had, plus this new thing that we tried out. And so we gave this patient this new drug class called ACE inhibitors. And after a few days, he got better and better. It was so exciting to see patients benefiting from it. And really, in many ways, we believe we saved his life. But the story I love to tell, which is real, was that at the end of his hospitalization, I was ready to send him home. I went up to him and say, "Mr. X, how are you going to be able to get home? Because I know that he, you know, he was very indigent." And I said, "Listen, I can give you some taxi dollars and I want to make sure that you're able to get home. He said to me, Doc, don't worry. I'm okay. I said, really? Where do you have the money? He reached into his pocket, came up with a roll of $10, $20. That last night I played cards with the other patient, I won. And for me, that was such a great moment because, you know, it's just reflecting that we have found a way to bring together science and treatment of patients that ultimately benefit this patient, not only because the patient lived longer, but if you can imagine, his brain's got much better. He was able to function really well. And that, to me, is probably very early in my career, gave me such excitement about taking care of patients and doing research at the same time.
Nice.
Well, and that breakthrough with ACE inhibitors and heart failure has saved a lot of lives going forward, and we're grateful for that. Shifting gears a little bit to being the leader of Duke Healthcare System, how did you approach that in terms of your vision for the healthcare system, and how did that change over time?
Yeah, Christy, I came, I've been at this job for 10 years now, and last week, the Board of Trustees of Duke University asked me to look back a decade.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the chance to go back to my, quote, acceptance speech. On April 27, 2004, President Broadhead, elect Broadhead, and President Andrew Cohen introduced me to the faculty. And I gave this speech, which I go back and look at what are the essential elements. And, you know, it was quite uncanny for me to look back and to say those were some of the major issues. You know, first, of course, it's about patients, patient-centeredness. Second is about bringing science to patients, as we talk about. Third is aligning the organization. I said the whole is greater than some of its parts. Well, it turns out this was very important for Duke because we just formed the health system a few years before my predecessor. So we have hospitals, community, you know, Duke Hospital, community hospitals. We have community physicians, Duke physicians, clinics. And then, of course, we have all the pieces, which is the medical school, the nursing school, the health system, and then the university. How do they all come together?
Mm-hmm.
So the alignment was very important. And then I talked about social determinants of health. Particularly looking at socioeconomic factors, translation. And, you know, so when I look back, those were the right elements. But I would say very fresh and not experienced. And I think over the years, I've learned a lot more about, you know, what's a vision versus how do you make it work.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that those elements still ring true today, that it is about improving health of community, try to eliminate health disparities, and also try to transform medicine through research, education, and excellent patient care. So the last point I want to make is that I'm very proud of the mission statement that we did for Duke Medicine in 2006, which is, you know, a little bit over a year after I got here. We got together everybody, and by that I mean physicians, nurses, staff, administration, to collectively say, who do we want to be and what are we about? And in a more traditional academic medical center, is usually about the triple threat. We want to be best in patient care, excellent in research, and outstanding in education. We actually wrote a statement, if you have a chance to look at it, to say we want to be leaders in transformation of health locally and globally, and we want to improve community health and eliminate health inequalities. We did put the fillers in between,
mm-hmm.
which is through discovery research,
right.
through translation, through education, et cetera. But I think, to me, that's so critical so that you can go back every day and just say, why are you doing this? And the mission is to improve health. But transformation includes the use of research and others to do things differently. So it can really make a big difference.
You know, we've had some amazing CEOs of healthcare industries here. And I think one of the things I've learned from them is that, and you've just alluded to this, Dr. Zhao, that it's, you've got the mission is one thing, making it happen is another. I wonder if you're thinking back on the close to a decade of experience at Duke University Healthcare, What's something that you can say, yes, we really did this. It worked the way we intended or even better than we intended. And then what's something that this has been hard? It hasn't quite worked the same way that I thought it might. Maybe you got it there, but maybe not.
Well, first, Adam, I agree with you. We have some great CEOs. Let me do a shout out for my friend Bill Roper. You guys are very lucky to have him because he truly is, one of the great leaders in medicine, and he's done a lot for the community and for
the UNC. The CEO of UNC Healthcare, yes.
Yeah, yes, the CEO of UNC Healthcare. Oh, I thought his name was so everyday, you know, household name. You got to know who he is, right? You haven't done your job, you haven't done that.
Mm-hmm. Certainly it's known to us.
I think that to me, patient safety, because you probably have been here long enough to know that Duke has gone through a whole series of patient safety issues before I came and after I came. So from Centillion, the lung transplant patient with a mismatch, to a number of things, but shall we, burn baby in neonatal ICU, to when I first came, shortly after I came, the hydraulic fluid. Now, so to me, there's no question that that cannot continue. And, you know, it's ironic. In fact, I'm going to Institute of Medicine because, as you know, one of the most famous studies Institute of Medicine has done is, in fact, the whole issue of patient quality and safety, right? So I would say that we decided this has got to be, we got to put the patient in the middle, center, patient-centered care, and we got to do everything we can to assure the best quality and the safest care. And we went through a transformation. You know, in addition to putting the organization in the right place, we have introduced things like called the just culture. We have introduced the concept that anybody who sees anything wrong can speak up. In the operating room, anybody can stop anything if they don't think it's going right. And I myself and our executives used to do walk rounds at every single ward throughout all our system, community hospitals, to talk to nurses, to talk to everyone about what worries you most. And out of all this, I believe we have become a very good system, if not a national leader in patient safety and quality. To the extent, not only are we asked to, tell other people about the program and lead, but more recently, you may not have read that we now are leading 50, 60 hospitals in the LifePoint system through the Medicare CMI grant to look at quality within community hospitals as a network. So we help them develop safety protocol, chief safety officers, and everyone reporting to us. And so I'm very proud of that piece. I think that's really, really worth it.
Nice.
That is
nice.
Something to be proud of. Nice. Yeah. You know, we do need to take a short break for our listeners, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Victor Zhao, recent CEO of Duke University Health System and president of the Institute of Medicine. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Victor Zhao, recent CEO of Duke University Health System and president of the Institute of Medicine, about healthcare leadership in a sea of uncertainty. And Dr. Zhao, you had spoken earlier in our conversation about your career and the importance of service. And I wonder if you could frame for us your role in the Institute of Medicine and how that fits in with service. And for our listeners who may not understand totally the role that the Institute of Medicine has in our nation.
Thank you, Christy. You know, if I can take a minute about service. In fact, 2 weeks ago, I gave the commencement address at Northeastern University. And my theme was passion and making a difference. And, you know, when people talk about, well, how do you, you know, the students are graduating, how can I be successful? I say, you know, success is really, it has to be in the right context. And it's usually defined through a rear view mirror, you know. But I think what you want to do is follow your passion and trying to make a difference. And I would say that some of you know I was born in China, and my family and I fled communist China, went to Hong Kong, and I came here to study when I was 18 on my own. And I feel that so much of what I've learned in my earlier life and subsequently being here given the opportunity in this country obviously is, you know, trying to make a difference and follow what you love to do most. So I think the Institute of Medicine, if I can call it IOM, easier for me, particularly my daughter said I still have an accent and I can't pronounce some of the words properly.
Is that that Southern accent?
Right. Southern China accent.
Okay, IOM.
IOM. You know, as many people encourage me to do that, did put in the context of service. And it is different from what I do now. I think what I do now is service, but I lead and manage a very large organization, and I do wake up every morning thinking about, is the train going to leave on time? How can we make sure everything is good? You know, and many other things. In Institute of Medicine, I have the chance to think a little bit more of a bigger picture, which certainly in the last number of years as a CEO of Duke Health System and as one of the nation's CEO of, you know, academic health centers, I've been thinking a lot, but this will enable me to really spend more time. So what it is Institute of Medicine is part of the National Academies. There are three academies, National Academy of Science, the National Academy of Engineering, and the Institute of Medicine. And I think in the 1860s, National Academy of Science was founded, congressionally chartered and signed by Abraham Lincoln as an independent, not-for-profit organization that advised the government on issues of science. Science those days is quite different from today. But I think the government also needed at the time some organization that you can go to and say, what do we do with this area? We don't know who to believe, and there's just too many politics around it. So, of course, as you know, National Academy of Science is a very prestigious organization, the highest in this country. And in 1960, the National Academy of Engineering was formed as the highest body for engineering. And in the 1970s, the Institute of Medicine.
So I know our listeners, they would instinctively know the Institute of Medicine, but they may not know, like I was reading the New York Times says, it's the most esteemed and authoritative advisor on issues of health and medicine, and its reports can transform medical thinking. That's pretty impressive. Very few would say that about a lot of other things.
I think my mother would be impressed with that.
And it is impressive. What needs transforming in today's healthcare system?
Yeah.
What will we be reading about, do you think, 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now that you know the Institute has to have a role in?
Right. So the Institute is to advise the government. It is non-political. It's now a very successful and prestigious institute. It has a lot of, you know, brilliant people who does policy issues. And we do about 60% of our work is with Congress, with the government, whether it is NIH, FDA, CDC, or executive branch of government, but a lot with Congress. And they will come and to ask the Institute to do a study, and deep dive, not just superficially, what do we do about this area? What's controversial? And so you can imagine healthcare, in medicine, and even in biomedical research, there are lots of issues that you need independent analysis. So we do influence a lot on policies in this country. We advise the government, trusted, they call it, advisor. So that's what is done, and it's done some really phenomenal stuff that really has changed the way we do things, you know, in this country. One famous one I mentioned earlier is actually patient safety, right?
Well, the first, also, Christy. Institute of Medicine has done a lot to raise awareness and in issues of tobacco. How, as you're thinking ahead, what do you think the big issues that you really want to lead and take on will be? I know we have to wrap up soon, but we'd love to just hear hope about what those tough issues you're going to tackle.
Let me answer the question this way first. I want to be sure that I'm representing the nation, not myself. I have my passion. I have my favorite things I really feel we need to tackle. But what I want to start off is a listening tour, you know, through the country to listen to not only members, but also the lay people and leaders in community, et cetera. What are the things that bother people that really feel we need to address? Because we're supposed to do those things that can serve the nation and to have the government listen to us. So that's my number one. When I finish that, I'd like to bring it all together and see the next 5 years, what are those five or whatever important issues.
I want to thank you on behalf of your health, but also thank you on behalf of the region of Durham and Chapel Hill and the country for a job that is difficult, but one that we're glad you're stepping forward for.
If I may, first of all, my wife and I love the Triangle area. We love North Carolina. We love Durham. We've been here for 10 years. We've decided this is our home. So while I'm working in Washington, we're actually keeping our home here, and I'm on leave of absence from Duke. I want to come back here. But in fact, we're going to do the commute thing. So I just want to thank, you know, North Carolina and, you know, the Triangle, Durham, Duke, for the opportunity to serve. And we feel very much part of this community, and we will remain as part of this community.
Well, we are grateful for that and grateful for the time you've taken to share that with us today, Dr. Zhao. Thank you for being with us. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you would like Christy or I to address on an upcoming show, please send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive director and producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call today.
My doctor told me I'm entering a stage of life change. Not that I was depressed or anxious, but my doctor mentioned I could experience depression and anxiety. Have you heard of this?
Actually, I have heard of it. It's actually one of these things that people don't talk about a lot, but the psychiatrists know it really quite well, which is it is not depression. It is not anxiety. It's not post-traumatic stress disorder. It could turn into any of these things. It's a natural stage of life change, like going from to be a teenager to a young adult to an adult, to having children. All these things are stages that one goes through.
Or when people become empty nesters and their children are all off to college, that's a big change in life. And that changes your relationship with your spouse and the things that you do with your time and makes you sort of reflect on your life a little bit more. And so, I mean, I'd be interested in knowing more what your doctor exactly meant with life change. Sometimes if it's right after having a baby, it's life change, but there are also hormonal changes and other things that can precipitate mood changes. But I think it's nice that your doctor's bringing that up and giving you some space and time to reflect on those changes in your life and to make sure that you're making plans for wellness and for adjusting to those changes to try to prevent that from being any sort of trigger for increased anxiety or depression.
Well said.
Thanks. Let's take our very next House Call question.
I went to my primary care doctor twice for itching of my hands. They told me I had hand eczema and was instructed to use a strong topical cream. It helped, but my hands have started to peel. I went to a dermatologist and they asked me to see my feet. I was surprised, but they immediately diagnosed me with a bad fungal infection of my feet. They called it an ID reaction. This seems wild.
Yeah, I think probably what that ID reaction you're talking about is what we would call an ID reaction, which is a reaction that is difficult to diagnose, and I give kudos to the dermatologist. It's not even easy for a dermatologist to always make that diagnosis because there's not a single test for it. But it's this idea that you can have a rash on your body that if you scraped it, it wouldn't show up a fungus, but you have a reaction, skin reaction elsewhere on your body, like a fungus infection of the feet, and that's causing that other reaction in your body through your immune system.
It is kind of wild that one, the rash that you're going to get treated was really just a sort of like a side manifestation or side symptom of what was actually going on in your feet the whole time. It is really interesting. It sounds like good news that you figured out what it was and that treating the infection on your feet should then take away that id reaction elsewhere on your body.
You know, if you have any skin condition and it's not getting better, certainly go back and see your doctor and, you know, get the answer you want. But show the doctor all the rashes that you have. You know, it could have been that if you had brought to your doctor's attention that you had really bad, you know, infections of your feet or feet that weren't quite right, they may have been able to figure this out. But again, that's a hard diagnosis. We're really glad that you made it. It's kind of like, you know, you take a pill for some conditions and you get a skin reaction to taking the pill. This is a skin reaction from the infection you already had. Glad you're better. Good luck.
Let's take our next house call question. Erica?
My mom died suddenly in her 50s from heart disease. I'm about to turn 50. I'm in great health and I exercise all the time. I started having chest pains 2 months ago after the realization came that I'm about to be 50. Should I have a stress test?
I think you're having your stress test now.
Yeah.
Things sound a little bit stressful, and I could understand why. This is a stage of life change, turning 50 frequently for many people, and with you and your mother and the concerns, I understand that.
And it's complicated because a person can certainly have chest pain simply because you're paying more attention to it and you're nervous and thinking about your mother, as you suggest. But it also could be real and could be caused by you having heart disease. So it is the kind of thing that you don't want to just ignore. You want to talk with your doctor. Go through, they'll have a bunch of questions of when the chest pain comes on and what makes it better and if it's happening when you're exerting yourself. And it may be that having a stress test is the right thing to do. And certainly being evaluated for other risk factors for heart disease and trying to make sure you've got good control on your blood pressure and your cholesterol and all of those things and you don't have diabetes, all of those things can really make a difference.
Unfortunately, sometimes when you have a very low risk of heart disease, a stress test may not actually be helpful. So that's why I agree, Christy, you need to go see your doctor and see what your risk is and then make a decision because you don't want to get a false positive test or you don't want to be into kind of a cascade where you start going into test and more tests. On the other hand, you don't want to ignore it. So make that appointment. Let us know how you're doing.
Let's take our last house call of the day.
I recently went to my doctor because I'm really tired. The doctor asked if I was depressed, and I said no, but that I was under stress. My doctor reached out to me and simply touched my knee and said stress can carry depression. I broke down and started crying. That simple act of compassion opened a very important door, so I wanted to share.
Oh, thank you for sharing. That's really, that's touching, actually, physically to hear about this story, but also emotionally to know the impact of a simple gesture.
And the beauty of that doctor-patient relationship. Sometimes you're in that room and you might not be ready to really admit to yourself or admit to anyone else how you're really feeling. But having a relationship with your provider where you feel comfortable and safe to really just let it out can sometimes be the very thing that allows you to get the treatment and the help that you need so you can feel better. So we are so glad that that happened for you and that you had a compassionate physician.
Yeah, starting to cry is actually a good thing in this particular circumstance because that was probably helpful and what we would call therapeutic. Because when the doctor asked you kind of in maybe a not so emotional way whether you were depressed or not, you said no. But yet reaching out and touching and kind of just saying you look depressed, that kind of triggered things. So I think all of us have a little bit of that compassionate doctor in us where we can listen and be a good friend and be supportive. That part is actually very helpful.
It is. Thank you for sharing. And we are grateful that that was helpful for you and hope that you're starting to feel better very soon.
Well, Christy, we've had a chance to talk about these simple acts of compassion, sometimes just a simple reassurance on the touch of the knee.
About chest pains and evaluating risk for heart disease.
About this ID reaction or the ID reaction and ways of making sure you get that primary fungus treated.
And about stage of life change or changes in your stage of life and how that might affect your stress and risk for symptoms of depression and anxiety.
Well, that'll conclude the House Calls today, and we want to thank all our listeners for joining us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed the issues and concerns that are important to you, and you can share your questions. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Victor Zhao. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.